So I do see some familiar faces, but I wonder if any of you are here for the first time. Okay, welcome. Thank you for coming on this rainy day, rainy, cold, foggy day. So I don't know if anyone introduced me, but I'll just say a little bit about myself, because I'm a relatively new person in this place. I came last September, but I've been in Buddhism for a long time. My name is, my Tibetan name is Sangye Khadro, or Venerable Khadro, but if that's too much to manage, I have a Western name, Kathleen. That's the name my parents gave me, so I'm happy with either name. And I'm from California originally, and I started learning Buddhism when I was about 21. I went to India and started studying at the library in Dharamsala, the Tibetan library. That's where the Dalai Lama lives. And I very quickly jumped right in. It was kind of what I was looking for. And so I've been learning, continuing to learn and practice since then. That's been about 45 years now. And also teaching sometimes. But I still see myself as a student because Buddhism is so vast. There's so much to learn. So, I mean, I'm still learning and growing, but I'm happy to share what I have learned with others who are interested. So this event today is called Sharing the Dharma. And that word Dharma is probably unfamiliar to some of you, right? It's a Sanskrit word. It's not in the English. I don't know if it's in the dictionary or not. It might be by now. But we use this word dharma to refer to spiritual teachings and spiritual practices, such as meditation and prayer, and also trying to live an ethical life, be kind to others, generous, and so forth. So we talk about learning dharma, studying dharma, practicing dharma, and teaching dharma. So if you hear that term dharma, that's generally what it means, like spiritual teachings. And so this event happens every month, except in the winter when it's too cold and too snowy to get up here. And usually the person teaching it is Venerable Thupten Chodron, who's the abbess, so some of you have probably met her. And she has been going through this book called An Open-Hearted Life, which is a really wonderful book. She wrote it together with a psychologist, Russell Coltz, who I haven't met, but he's a professor at Eastern Washington University. Where is that? So it's not too far from here. Yeah. And he practices a kind of therapy called compassion-focused therapy, which sounds really wonderful. So this book is basically about how to have more compassion, how to be more compassionate, both from the Western psychological point of view and also the Buddhist point of view. And I haven't read the whole book, but what I have read, I think it's really wonderful. It's really fantastic. And it isn't just about theory, but also about practical tools where we can have more compassion in our life. But so anyway, each time there is a Sharing the Dharma Day, Venerable Chodron goes through a chapter of this book. But I thought before going into that, I'll just give a little bit of an introductory talk to Buddhism, because some of you might be new to Buddhism, so jumping right into this book might be a bit too much for you. So the Buddha taught for about 45 years, and people sometimes ask me, is there a Buddhist Bible? The essence of Christianity can be contained in the Bible, which is one book, or sometimes it's divided into two, the Old Testament, the New Testament. But anyway, it's one or two books. But the Buddha's teachings comprise many books, like all these things you see over here, these are books, these are texts in Tibetan language that contain the Buddha's words. So there's a lot there. And a lot of it hasn't even been translated into English. So that would be challenging for us to study all of it. However, it's possible to summarize the essential points of Buddha's teachings into some kind of relatively simple formula, one of which is the Four Noble Truths. And that's the very first thing the Buddha taught. And it is a useful way of encapsulating Buddha's teachings. So I'll just briefly go through those to give you some idea what Buddhism is all about. So there's just four points there, not too difficult. The first one is called the truth of suffering. Now, the word suffering we probably recoil from, you know, we don't want to hear about that. but what the Buddha was trying to do was just point out that it is part of life. We all have it. I mean, some people, I've experienced this myself and also heard other people say it, you know, we have like mental suffering or we have physical suffering or both. And we sometimes may think, I'm the only one. You know, we look around at other people and they look like they're doing well and they're happy. And we may think, oh, they don't have any problems and I'm the only one who does. But it's actually not true. Everybody has problems. Even like really wealthy people, billionaires and celebrities, the beautiful people, the rich and famous people, they have problems too. Now, just having this kind of body, this physical body, we get sick, we have aches and pains, we get old, and eventually we all die. So even rich and famous people have those kinds of problems. And then we also have inner problems in our mind, in our heart. We have unhappiness and frustration and boredom and restlessness and anger and irritation and, you know, a whole range of different kinds of emotional problems. So everybody experiences those. One woman told me she'd suffered from depression most of her life, but she always felt like she had to hide it from others. And she believed she was the only person who was depressed and everybody else was happy. And then she came to her first Buddhist teaching and heard that everybody suffers, and she felt so much relief. You know, I'm not the only one who suffers. Other people suffer too. So that can be very helpful to just be aware, you know, that suffering is a part of life. It's a natural part of life. But then the Buddha didn't just stop there. Sometimes people say, oh, Buddhism is so pessimistic because he talks about suffering. But Buddha didn't only talk about suffering. He went on and talked about, why do we suffer? I mean, that's an important question. Why do we have to suffer? Why can't life be wonderful and perfect and easy and smooth and we never have any problems? Why? So he looked into that, because the Buddha was once like ourselves. He wasn't always a Buddha. He wasn't always enlightened. But he was once an ordinary person like us, and he had suffering too. And he wanted to know why. And what can we do about it? Is there a solution to it? And so he looked into that with meditation, spiritual practice, spiritual meditation. And what he discovered was that the main causes, there's many causes of suffering, and some of them are external, like natural disasters or nasty people. endless list of things out there. But he also discovered that within ourselves, there are factors that lead to suffering. And the main ones of these are what are called disturbing emotions or disturbing states of mind or negative states of mind. There's different terms for these. But they include things like anger, hatred, and also greed, and jealousy and selfishness. And so there's like a whole bunch of these different disturbing states of mind that come up in us and make our mind disturbed and unhappy and unpeaceful. And then they can also, if we don't know how to manage them, they can also cause us to act in certain ways that create more suffering and more problems, like killing, harming, being addicted to unhelpful substances, and so on. So basically, then, the causes of suffering, the sources of suffering that the Buddha discovered in his own experience and looking at the world around him, are disturbing emotions, disturbing states of mind, and the actions, which means karma. You've probably heard of karma. That's in the dictionary, I know. Karma basically just means actions, but it means here actions motivated by disturbing emotions like anger, hatred, and so on. So those are the main causes of suffering. And then he discovered that it's possible to get rid of all of this, to be free of all of this. That's the third truth. So the first truth then is suffering. The second one is the causes of suffering. And the third one is what's normally called the cessation of suffering. Cessation isn't a word we normally use in our daily language, but it just means getting rid of suffering and its causes. And that's a possible thing to do. It's doable. And so what the Buddha discovered was there's this a state of mind that can be attained that's completely free of all different forms of suffering, unsatisfying, unpleasant experiences, as well as these disturbing emotions that lead to it. And we this is sometimes called nirvana. I'm sure that's in the dictionary too. It was also the name of a rock group. I don't know, are they still existing or no? No. Anyway, so it's a state of peace, of freedom, of just being really, really happy all the time, you could say. No more suffering, no more problems. And he realized, so he attained that state and he discovered that anybody else can as well. It's doable for anybody. It's attainable for anybody. So then the question is how to do it, how to get there. And that's the fourth noble truth, which we usually call the path. And the path here just means what we need to do to bring about this transformation of our mind. Because that's basically what we're doing, is working on our mind and bringing about a transformation of our mind, transforming it so that we have less suffering, less unhappiness, less disturbing emotions. Those are gradually decreased and eventually eliminated altogether, so they don't exist anymore. And more of the positive. We also have positive states of mind, positive emotions, like compassion and love, kindness, peacefulness, wisdom. So those are increased more and more and more and more until our whole mind is pervaded by these positive states of mind. We're always in a positive state of mind and no more negativity. So it's a gradual process, gradual transformation. But it's doable. It is possible to do. And a few times when attending teachings by the Dalai Lama, I heard him say that the essence of Buddhism is transforming our mind, meaning decreasing the negative or disturbing aspects of the mind and increasing the positive and beneficial aspects of the mind more and more and more until our mind becomes completely pure and positive and perfect. And I was really happy to hear him say that because, like I said before, Buddhism is quite complicated and complex. There's all these teachings and different kinds of practices that we do, and it can be overwhelming when you first start looking into Buddhism and trying to understand Buddhism. So it was really nice to hear Buddhism encapsulated in that way. It's like putting Buddhism in a nutshell. The essence of Buddhism is transforming our mind, bringing about a positive transformation of our mind. And why do we do this? What's the reason or purpose for doing this? So that we will be happier. Because these disturbing negative states of mind are what make us unhappy, and they can also cause other people to be unhappy when we, you know, act them out with them and create lots of problems in the world, like war and violent crime and, you know, different kinds of social problems that we have. So they bring unhappiness for ourselves and others. And nobody wants to be unhappy. Everybody wants to be happy. So we want to get rid of the causes for unhappiness and increase the causes for happiness. The positive emotions, positive states of mind are the ones that bring happiness. So if we can decrease the negative ones and increase the positive ones, we will be happier, healthier, have greater well-being, and we'll also bring that to others, help others to have more happiness as well. Okay, so that's just a quick summary of the main message of the Buddha, the main message of Buddha's teachings. And I've mentioned before this word dharma. The word dharma is used to refer to the Buddhist teachings and practices and so forth. And way back when I was first studying Buddhism in India, and I kept hearing this word dharma, 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 and I didn't really get a clear explanation of it, so I was curious about it. And I had a chance to talk to a lama who spoke English, and I asked him, what is dharma anyway? And he gave a really beautiful answer. He said, the dharma is like a mirror for our mind. Just as we use an ordinary mirror like you have hanging on your bathroom wall to look at our face, our hair, our clothes, and just check if we look okay or not before we go out. And if there's something dirty or something amiss, we can fix it up. But we cannot see our mind in an ordinary glass mirror. It only shows us the surface of our body, but not the inside, what's going on inside of us. So that's what the Dharma enables us to do. It enables us to look at our mind and understand what's going on in our mind. And if there's something there that is kind of messy or out of shape or out of order and needs to be worked on, needs to be fixed up. So when I heard that, I found that really kind of interesting and juicy, and I really wanted to know more about that. Also, the very first Buddhist book I ever read, even before I went to India, I was in university, is a book called Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind by a Japanese teacher, Suzuki Roshi, who came to California and lived there for many years. And it's a wonderful book. It's like a classic in English language Buddhist books. And I came across a sentence in there that also, it's kind of similar. It's from a previous Zen master called Dogen. And it said, to study Buddhism is to study yourself. And there's more to it than that, but just that phrase itself, studying Buddhism means studying yourself. I also found that really appealing because I really wanted to understand myself. I had a lot of unhappiness and a lot of inner disturbances and inner conflicts, and I just didn't know what to do about them and how to manage them. So I thought the idea of learning about myself, learning about my mind was really appealing. So the point then is that if we learn Dharma, the teaching is given by the Buddha and other Buddhist masters, that gives us an opportunity to look at our mind and understand our mind and be able to recognize what in our mind is problematic, is the cause of unhappiness and problems for ourselves and others. And it doesn't only do that, but it also gives us a lot of very practical tools or methods for working on our mind and transforming our mind. And that's, for me personally, one of the things that really drew me to Buddhism, because I didn't grow up in a Buddhist family. My family were actually Catholic, so I grew up in a Catholic environment, going to church every Sunday, going to Catholic schools for 12 years. But one of the things I found kind of disheartening was, you know, we were told to be good and kind and generous and so on and so forth, all these positive qualities. And I did want to be that way, but I found I couldn't always. And there were no methods, no practical methods or tools as to how to be that way in case you're not like that naturally. I mean, we had all the stories of the saints. You know, my grandmother used to tell me the story of Saint Teresa of Lisieux, who was this saintly child, like, you know, right from the beginning. She was just so obedient and loved her parents and loved everybody, and everybody loved her. And then she became a nun when she was only 14. And she was just like a natural saint. So I was told this story when I was a child. And yeah, I wanted to be like her, but I wasn't like her at all. I was naughty, and I, you know, fought with my parents and my brothers and sisters, and I had all these. Anyway, so it was quite discouraging. And like I said, I didn't come across any tools or methods as to how to be like that, how to be more saintly. It's almost like, well, you're born that way or you're not, and there's not much you can do about it. So, so I was really happy when I started learning Buddhism to discover all these methods and tools that you can use to change your mind and transform your mind, transform your emotions. But one thing is, do we think that that's possible? Yeah, do we see that it's possible that we can change ourselves? I think sometimes people think, well, this is just how I am. I've always been like this, and I can't change. I think some people believe that. And if we think that way, if we think it's impossible to change, then maybe we won't even try. We'll just keep being the way we are. And I was thinking the other day about something I experienced when I was 16 years old. I'm one of five children, three boys and two girls. And when my sister was born, I was really happy because I had been sandwiched between two boys for many years. And I was really happy to have a sister. So I was really delighted to have a little sister until I became a teenager. And then some of my friends had their own rooms, their own bedrooms, and I wanted my own bedroom too. But we didn't have enough rooms in the house for every child to have their own bedroom, so I had to share with my sister. And I really resented that. It was almost like I blamed her. And I was really unkind to her for a while. I really treated her badly, you know. I mean, it wasn't her fault, poor thing, but, you know. Anyway. But then, I don't know, when I was about 16, I can't remember what was the process in my mind, but I decided I wasn't going to be mean to her anymore, and I was going to be nice to her. I was going to love my little sister. And it seems like almost overnight, I was able to change just by making that decision, you know, that I'm going to be nice to her. I probably felt guilty, you know. It was clear that it wasn't a nice way to be. So I just made that decision, and I was able to do it. Yeah, so I discovered, even before I met Buddhism, that it is possible to change ourselves if we really want to, really see some, you know, benefit in doing that and reason to do that. We can do it. And another example, recently I read a really fantastic book. I think it's called The Sun Also Shines by Anthony Ray Hinton. Have you heard of him? He was on death row for 38 years for crimes he didn't commit in Alabama. He's black, poor, and they just decided there were these murders that had been committed, and they couldn't find the murderer, and they just decided to make him the murderer. And the whole trial, everything was just set up. So he was convicted, sent to death row, and of course, you know, he tried to appeal, but it took 38 years before he was finally, what's the word, acquitted? Yeah, and released. So he was on death row in a horrible prison, a horrible, 23 hours a day in a hot, stuffy cell, no air conditioning. Sometimes he said it was like 110 degrees in there, not even a fan. Oh, it sounded like hell. And he said, the story is wonderful. I really recommend it. First 3 years, he was just angry all the time, and he refused to talk to anybody. It's quite understandable, you know, that he'd be angry. And good reason to be angry. But then he changed and decided to start being nice to people. And he was nice to the guards. He was nice to his fellow prisoners. He did a lot of really good things. And it was really because he decided to do that. He was able to change. I mean, it was also because he had a wonderful mother who brought him up, you know, with a lot of love, unconditional love, and religion, the Bible, and so on. So he did have good, you know, early experiences in his life. But, yeah, he was able to change himself, and he was also able to change the people around him just by making that decision to be kind, to be nice. And I heard about another inmate who made himself happy or kept himself happy while he was in prison by focusing on the good qualities of the people around him, including his fellow prisoners, the guards, and so on. So instead of focusing on their faults and being angry and negative and blaming towards them, he would look for their good qualities and focus on that. And that was a way that he was able to keep himself positive and happy. So these are just some examples of how it is possible. Other people do it, and we can do it too. If we really want to, we can change our state of mind. But one very important factor here is taking responsibility for our mind and our emotions, which is actually the topic of the chapter that I'm supposed to be talking about today in this book. I won't read the whole thing. I'll just read a few passages and talk about them. But up to now, the book is talking about disturbing emotions and how it is possible to change and have more positive emotions like compassion and work on the disturbing ones like anger. This chapter is called Being Responsible for Our Emotions. And so it starts off saying, someone once commented to me, Chodron, she's the author, I want to appear responsible, but I don't want to be responsible. That sounds familiar. Many of us have that attitude. Nevertheless, we are responsible for our emotions. That doesn't mean it's our fault if we experience disturbing emotions such as anger and fear. But it does mean we have to work with them when they come up. So I think we probably all feel when anger comes up in our mind, we probably don't really want it to be there. It's not that we choose to be angry. I mean, I know that's my experience. I don't want to be angry. I don't want to be an angry, nasty, bad-tempered person. But somehow it just happens, right? Out of the blue. You know, these kind of emotions just come up. And so being responsible for our emotions doesn't mean it's our fault, it's our choice, and we should feel bad and guilty when disturbing emotions come up. Okay, that's not the meaning. Does that make sense? Now, there's different explanations as to why these things come up in our mind, even though we don't want them to. Buddhism has an explanation, which is probably a little challenging for some people to accept. But according to Buddhism, our mind isn't something that started in this lifetime, but it lived before. You've probably heard about this, reincarnation. Our mind has actually been existing a long time. And even before this life started, before this body came into existence in our mother's womb, our mind was already somewhere else in another body in another life having experiences. And before that, it was another one. Before that, it was another one. So that means that our mind started off this life not like a blank slate, clean and clear and pure, but already carrying with it a lot of imprints from our previous lives. So if we got angry in past lives, then the anger left imprints in our mind or seeds in our mind for anger to come up again in this lifetime. If we get angry now, it's because we got angry before in other lifetimes. We already have a habit. We already have that habit of being angry from past lives. So that's the Buddhist explanation. And I know for many people that would be difficult to accept. There's other explanations, for example, from Western science, brain science. They say our brain is already wired to respond with anger because of our ancestors. Our early ancestors needed anger in order to survive. They needed anger and fear and different emotions just to survive. So we kind of inherit these emotions. We inherit this kind of brain, which is already, you know, pre-programmed or wired to experience these emotions. So whatever explanation makes more sense to you, I think in either case, it means that it isn't really our fault or our choice that we get angry or that we have these different emotions. Okay, it's sort of like already there from day one, from the first moment of our life, right? And then, of course, conditioning experiences in this life can also be a factor. You know, if we grow up in a family, in a household where there's a lot of anger or there's other kind, or the abuse or alcoholism and so on, and that can also influence us so that we have more of these kind of emotions. So whatever the cause, whatever the reason, whatever the source of our emotions, it's, again, I think it isn't really our fault or our choice to have these emotions in the first place. But the good news is we can do something about it. We can change. When anger comes up in our mind, we do have choices. I like to think of it as like, I know in many countries in the roads, they have what's called a roundabout. I think they're starting to have them here as well. You come to a place and there's this circle and then there's these different roads going off in different directions. So when you come to a roundabout, you can choose which road you want to go down. So it's similar when emotions come up in our mind. It's like coming to a roundabout in the road. There are different roads we can follow. There's the anger road. We can do that, sure. No problem. We've done that many times before. But there are other choices. There are other roads we can go down. We may need to learn. I mean, we do need to learn. We need, you know, help from other people to learn how to go down these different roads. But once we do, then we have that choice. Okay, I don't have to go down the anger road. There's this other road, which is much nicer. The patience road. The compassion road. Okay, so anyway, she says here, whether disturbing emotions arise due to ignorance, misconceptions, and our interpretation of previous experiences, this is the Buddhist explanation, or if they arise from the interaction of our current experience, previous learning history, and the tendencies of our animal brains, that's the Western science explanation, we do not need to blame ourselves for having them. Instead, we need to deal with the present situation. Our disturbing emotions are present, and now we have the choice of how to respond to them. So what happened in the past, we don't know, and we don't have any control over it. It's already gone, done, finished, over. We can't change the past. But there's this present moment, this present situation, and there we do have some choice, some control, some ability to change things. So that's the important thing, okay? Right now there's anger in my mind, and I can do something about it. I don't have to just follow it and act it out and go down the anger road. Do we fuel them by dwelling on them, or do we subdue them by applying an antidote? The choice is ours. Okay, so does that make sense? That, are you able to accept that, or at least be open to that possibility that there is a choice? One thing that sometimes happens is when anger comes up, we get angry or irritated or whatever, there's a tendency to blame others, to find someone to point the finger to. And once when I was teaching in Australia, this one man who came to the course told us about his experience. He said he'd had a lot of anger before, and he'd been in the military for a period of time, and he felt that the training he received in the military was designed to make the soldiers more angry. I don't know if that's true or not, but that was his view. I mean, it kind of makes sense. I guess if you're too passive and peaceful, you may not make a very good soldier. So so the training, you know, kind of really pushed anger out of him. And then even after leaving the military, he was working on offices and so on. But he had the tendency to always blame other people for his anger. This person, that person, that person, that situation. And then one day he was at home, and he lived alone in a house that was somewhat isolated. He didn't have any close neighbors. And he found himself getting angry. And it finally occurred to him, there's nobody around to blame. Not even a kangaroo. or a mouse in the house or whatever. And I finally, you know, realized, wait a minute, you know, this is my stuff. This is coming from me. So that was like the first time in his life that he took responsibility for his anger. And that's a really important insight. Yeah, I mean, this is very much in line with Buddhism. Even though there may be people out there who are doing things or saying things or things that are going on that make us angry, that's definitely true. But if we didn't have within us the habit or the tendency, or we call it seeds, like seeds of anger in our mind, we wouldn't get angry. Yeah, because you might notice this sometimes. There's a situation that happens, something goes wrong, and different people react differently. One person gets really angry, explosively angry. Somebody else, oh well, yeah, that happened, but they don't get angry about it. Have you ever noticed that? So that kind of shows it's not really what's going on out there, what the other person is doing or saying or whatever, but what's going on inside. Yeah? So being able to recognize that, being able to, that's part of taking responsibility. That, you know, there's something about me that's leading to this anger. And again, the point is we do have a choice about what we do with our mind, with our emotions. And that's not to say that... I mean, in Buddhism, we have a lot of different methods or tools, antidotes that we use to work on our mind and our emotions. But that means kind of being your own therapist. And that's sometimes hard to do. Sometimes you might be able to do it, but sometimes it's too hard for you. I find that sometimes. I feel like my mind just keeps going around in circles. And it's hard to find a way out of that roundabout. And so sometimes it is helpful to talk to somebody else, and that somebody else could be a spiritual teacher or a spiritual, even a friend, a good friend, a wise friend, or a therapist if it's really complex. Okay, so it's fine to talk to somebody else and try to get help, but can that person change your mind for you? Shucks. That would be nice, wouldn't it, just to go and pay some money and get, you know. And she does talk about that in here. She says, who can change these disturbing emotions and unbeneficial emotional habits? We can. In fact, no one else can alleviate our disturbing emotions, even though others may influence us in positive ways and help us to do so. For example, while a friend or a therapist may give us good advice on how to manage our anger, we are the ones who must put the advice into practice and change ourselves. Does it make sense? Yeah, because our mind is something internal and personal, and nobody can fix it for us or change it for us, although people can give us advice. And also, example. Being an example is very helpful as well. Like, I love this expression, actions speak louder than words. You know, when you see a person, if you're being around a person who's, you know, not so likely to get angry and is more calm, patient, kind, being around that person, you might find yourself becoming more like that as well, even without them saying anything. Just the influence, the example of that person. So that's also a very helpful way of getting ourselves to change. But just to mention a couple of antidotes or methods or tools that we could try on our own. One is just being aware, just being mindful of what's going on inside of ourselves, and then labeling it or noting it. This happened to me yesterday. Yesterday at breakfast, I noticed that I was feeling irritated. There were a few things that didn't go as smoothly as I would have liked. And I noticed this irritation inside of me, which hadn't been there before. I'd been quite happy. But I found that just noting it, just noticing it, and saying, oh, there's irritation in the mind, somehow that helps. It's like you get a chance to step back and observe it objectively. And what I find really helpful, instead of saying, I am irritated, or I am angry, or I am frightened, to say, that is in my mind. Anger is in my mind, or irritation is in my mind, or anxiety is in my mind. Because according to Buddhism, it's just a state of mind. It's a temporary, transitory state of mind. We say like clouds in the sky, they're transitory. They come and they go. They're not always there, even in Washington. So, no, really, a few days ago, the sky was clear, it was sunny. Now it's cloudy, but, you know, in a few days, the clouds will be gone and it'll be clear again. So our emotions are like that, or like the weather. They come and they go. Sometimes it's cloudy, sometimes it's sunny. So just to remind ourselves of that is really helpful. Okay, so yesterday there was some irritation in the mind, but today it's gone. And we've all had that experience. We can all think back on days when we felt terrible. We were, you know, miserable or angry or frustrated or depressed or whatever. But then, you know, it changed after a while. So just reminding ourselves that it's just a state of mind and it's going to pass. It's going to change. It's not going to be there forever. That's really helpful. That's one little method or tool that you can use. And then another thing is to think of something positive, like that inmate I mentioned who would focus on the positive things, the good things about the people around him. Of course, we can find plenty of things to complain about. Faults, mistakes, you know, things we don't like. That's easy to do. Mind just does that naturally. But you know, there's always good things in everybody. Everybody has some good qualities. And if we look for them, it might be a little hard sometimes, but we can always find something good in everybody. And just focusing more on that instead of the negative things, that will also help the mind to be more positive. And also about ourselves. Sometimes we can be very self-critical, self-judgmental, focusing more on our faults and our mistakes and our shortcomings and ignoring the good things. Okay, so if you notice your mind doing that, that can be changed. Actually, I'll recommend another book that I found really helpful. It's called Buddha's Brain. Anyone came across that? It's by Rick Hansen. He's a neuropsychologist, I think, and also a Buddhist meditator and teacher. It's a wonderful book. And it's quite easy to read, and he's kind of comparing Buddhism, the Buddhist explanation of things and meditation and so forth, and brain science, how our brains work. One thing I really liked about this book, he said, our brains are actually wired to pay more attention to negative things. And this is believed to be because of our early ancestors. They had to pay attention to the danger around them. There's plenty of dangers to be on the lookout for, but positive things weren't that important, weren't life-threatening. So he said our brains are actually wired that way, but we can change it. If we make an effort to pay more attention to good things, positive things, both outside of ourselves and other people and around us and also in ourselves, then we can change our brains because they're plastic. Neuroplasticity. So we can make an effort and it will start to become more natural to notice the positive things. Okay, I'll just mention one more thing and then I'll leave you some time to ask questions. Another thing that's helpful is to remind ourselves that we're not alone, like I mentioned before. When we're feeling unhappy or depressed or angry, and even if there's maybe good reasons to feel that way, but just to remember you're not alone. Other people have the same kind of problems you do. Because there is this tendency in the mind when we have a problem to get self-absorbed and almost feel as if I'm the only person in the world who has this problem. And it's just not true. There's lots of other people who have the same problem or at least similar problem to you do. Reminding yourself of that helps to open up our heart and have more compassion, more kindness. We realize other people suffer too. Wow, Now I know how they feel. And then we can empathize with them and have compassion for them. And that's a really beautiful state of mind. And you can also transform that into something positive, like, well, I really want to learn how to manage this problem so that I can help others who have this kind of problem too. That makes sense? So that's also a really helpful thing to do when we're experiencing some kind of problem or disturbing emotion. So these are just a few methods, but there's many more methods that we can use for working on disturbing emotions and changing them. It does take time, so don't expect, you know, overnight, no more anger, only peaceful, positive feelings. But if we do put time and energy into it, we definitely can change. And I can say that firsthand experience. I've seen a lot of changes in myself, so I know it's true. I know it works. And just one last thing. When we talk about working on our mind, transforming our mind, that doesn't mean that if there is some kind of problem going on out there, we should just sit and meditate and change our mind and not do anything about the problems out there. Doesn't mean that. If there are things going on out there that are causing problems for yourself, for others, it is fine to try to change them, if you can. It's not always possible, but at least you can try, as long as what you're doing is ethical, non-violent, non-harmful. You can at least try to bring about changes in other people and in situations in society and the world. But if you only try to do that and you don't try to work on yourself and your own mind, that's not so wise. Yeah. I once met a man who told me he'd been working for 30 years to bring about peace in the world, but he gave up and got discouraged because he said all the groups trying to bring about peace, they keep fighting with each other and and among themselves, and, you know, so they don't accomplish much. So that just shows we really do have to work on ourselves, but at the same time, we can work on changing others. I love that quote from Gandhi, be the change you want to see in the world. And I think that's so true. We have to change ourselves before we can change others and change the world. Okay, so we have a little bit of time left if anyone would like to ask a question.
So getting back to the third noble truth, which is the cessation of suffering, I think actually you kind of addressed my concern or comment that I've had when you just finished up here now. But I still wanted to say that the cessation of suffering and we can become happy, I think sometimes it can be conflated into in people thinking that Buddhism, probably I had this thought too in the beginning, that we're just all blissed out and everything, you know, we should always see the positive in everything. And I remember my brother saying to me, oh, you just want to see everything with rose-colored glasses, you know, and that kind of stuff. And I don't think that's it at all, because for me, that would have been a path of kind of fear and denial and sticking my head in the sand, like, something horrific happened on the news. I just don't want to deal with that. Yeah. I just want to think positive, happy thoughts. And, you know, and so, but when I think of somebody like His Holiness the Dalai Lama, for example, who really has this unshakable joy that really is genuine, and you can just feel it within him. But it's also very grounded, and he's very engaged, and he doesn't turn or shy away from suffering in himself or others. And I just thought that was really important for me in the beginning.
Yeah, I think it's true what you say, that people can sometimes, I mean, it's probably we already have this tendency to want to run away from, escape from, ignore, deny suffering, and we try to get into a spiritual path. And actually, there's a term for this. They call it spiritual bypassing. Have you heard that? I mean, one psychologist coined that term. It means like trying to use spiritual teachings and spiritual practices to avoid dealing with your own stuff. He's mainly talking about your own emotional problems and unresolved stuff, you know, just trying to avoid them. And you do all this meditation and mantras and blissful visualizations, but you're not dealing with your stuff. So sooner or later, that stuff is going to come out. So you have to face it. So I think it's similar, though, with things in the world. Yeah, I mean, we need a balance, okay? Because if we get too much into the world and trying to make changes, then you have this kind of problem I mentioned just now of, you know, not working on yourself, and you end up with a lot of anger, a lot of frustration. So we do need both, working on ourselves, but also working on trying to bring about positive changes in the world. That's a good point.
Well, I found that book really helpful.
This one?
Yes. I had a very difficult year last year with changes at work, and I find myself getting very angry. I found that book enormously helpful in dealing with my anger over the situation. And really helped me out with other things. Mm-hmm. Specifically, the thing I'm kind of most often doing currently is the people I'm most triggered by, people that I say both Jewish and Buddhist prayers for every day.
Wonderful.
I think of my immediate Jewish prayer every happy day. And I found that book enormously effective in dealing with very practical with a very difficult situation.
Sounds like you've come a long way. You can actually say prayers for those people. It just reminded me of this story I heard when there was this terrible shooting in the synagogue. Where was that in New York? Yeah, and the shooter. What's the word for him? The person who did the shooting was wounded and brought to a hospital, and he was cared for by Jewish doctors and so on, and they treated him with so much kindness, so much care, even though he'd done this horrendous crime against their people. That was just so moving, so beautiful to hear that.
Yeah, that was one of the things this year.
One of the things for you that...
Yeah, I was out in Ohio dealing with a terribly serious illness of family. Mm-hmm. And it was right at the worst part of what I've been doing with the horse. It was really helpful. I went with me to
Yeah. Now, it is inspiring to hear stories like this of how other people are able to not react with so much anger and hatred. And yeah. Well, they can do it. I can do it too. Oh. Is there one more question?
You already covered it more or less, but just to clarify and really put a point on it, is it ever appropriate to feel responsible or accountable for another being's feelings or their suffering directly?
Is it ever appropriate to feel responsible for another person's feelings? If we look honestly at our actions and also our motivation, and we can see that we acted unwisely, unskillfully, and you know, with some afflictive emotions or disturbing emotions, then I think we can say we did make some contribution to that person's suffering. If the other person didn't have within themselves the seeds to feel what they felt, then you know, they had that. But there's lots of different causes and conditions giving rise to anything that happens. So when an experience comes up, a feeling comes up, an emotion comes up, it's not just one single cause. It's many different causes, many different factors. So it's possible that we did contribute to that. And if we recognize that, then it is good to apologize, make amends, try to help. And actually, it's said in one text that even if we didn't have any, we can honestly say we had no intention to hurt that person or make that person upset. But if they did get upset, it still makes sense to, you know, reach out to them, apologize, do what we can to make them feel better.
Yeah, I was
trying to understand better what the extent is to where the other person is kind of unwilling to ask things to change their future about themselves. Would it be better trying to work with them and then about that, you know,
That's a good question. I mean, my first thought is, just as it says in here, nobody can change our mind in the same way we cannot change somebody else's mind. So that's something we need to accept. However much we may wish to, we really want to change that person's mind and get them to see things in a different way, in a more helpful, positive way, but we can't do that. We can't force, even the Buddha, you see, even the Buddha isn't able to do that, to change somebody else's mind. Only they can change their mind, but we can still do things that might contribute to that, being kind to them, making prayers, if you believe in prayer. I do. I think prayers can be very helpful. Making prayers for them, hoping, wishing. But yeah, it doesn't help to get frustrated and maybe feel guilty because you're not able to do that. Does that make sense? Yeah. So find a balance, you know. Don't completely give up and think, oh, I can't do it and I'm not even going to try. But also don't get too much involved and then get frustrated and maybe feel bad that you're not able to change them. Does that make sense? It's a good question. Really good.